Okay, our last talk of the symposium is going to be given by Jerry Hatfield, Conservation Practices and Their Potential to Mitigate Climate Change.
Thanks, Warren. Realizing that I stand between you and lunch, you know, that's an incentive. Let me acknowledge my co-authors, Tim Parkin, Tom Sauer, and John Pruger from the lab. We've spent a lot of time on this topic over the last few years, looking at various aspects of it, talking about these different issues. And if we look at climate change, we really have got three components of this. We've got temperature, we've got precipitation, and we have carbon dioxide as all changing, and they're changing in many different ways. And I'm going to just give you the premise of this from a climate change or climate variability perspective. If we just look at the contiguous United States, it's been an interesting thing on the whole U.S. basis is that the last few years have been wetter than what we've seen in the past. And so we've had this tendency to be wetter. However, that does not apply when you look at the regionality of it. And I think this is the piece of this that when we really begin to narrow it down, we realize that not all parts of the United States have changed the same way or have shown the same degree of climate variation or response to the climate change out there. If we look at temperature, southeastern United States is actually cool a little bit. The Midwest really hasn't changed much at all. The western part of the United States has actually gotten very warm, and we all know that Alaska has warmed a great deal in all of this. So all of these have implications for us. If we look at an interesting piece of this puzzle in terms of days above 90 degrees, because people are often interested in heat extremes, we see that from 1961 to 1979 average, if you look across that upper Midwest, there's roughly somewhere around 10 days maybe in northern or even zero in the other part of northern Iowa, you know, less than 10 days as you move down. However, we roll this clear to the end of the century, we're going to be a lot warmer. And so as this whole warming environment takes place, all of a sudden we're going to see that those areas of Texas that went through the heat of 2011, which actually just blew away the heat records from 1936, which is the warmest year on record since then, these may become more common. These high temperature events, high extremes that we experience, are going to continue to increase. And so that's going to place a demand upon our cropping systems and our livestock systems that are unprecedented in what we've seen before. And our modern agricultural practices are not based on these high temperature extremes. We also see that there's a phenomena, because the other piece of this puzzle is that even though there may be little change in terms of the mean temperatures or a slight change in terms of mean temperatures, the largest change is occurring is in the minimum temperatures. The maximum temperatures are not changing as rapidly as the minimum temperatures. Two reasons for that. Again, part of that greenhouse effect of the gases is basically to trap a lot of that energy in at night. The other one that often is not talked about at all is that the major variable that's changing in our atmosphere is water vapor. And water vapor, we know, is an extremely good barrier to loss of water or loss of heat at night. So we see this changing. We project the nighttime temperatures to become much warmer as we go through this overall process. Precipitation changes, again, are variable around this. So we see all sorts of things going on. And again, on a contiguous basis, it's one thing, but when you look on a regional basis, it's something else. Again, a little bit wetter across the Midwest, a little drier across the Great Plains, the Southwest. And again, Alaska has a schizophrenic personality. Part of it's been wetter and part of it's been drier than what it's had before. But in reality, here's the projection as we go into the future and you think about trending towards this, is that our lower part of the United States is going to be drier during the winter, the upper part of the United States wetter in the spring, drier across, again, the southern parts of the southern tiers, wetter across the Midwest. Summer for everybody is projected to become much drier. And because we're a rain-fed agricultural system, for the most part, it says that we're going to face water limitations as we go through this. So when we think about this overall puzzle in terms of water management, it becomes much more serious than what we think about. It becomes much more serious than saying, how do we begin to manage our water supply in different ways than what's out here? Finally, rolling into the fall, it's the Great Plains that tend to be drier going into the fall period, and the rest of the U.S. a little change from where it is today. So you think about this changing seasonality. We've already seen this in the record. We see the upper Midwest is already becoming wetter in the spring. A number of things that have changed already, and we begin to see that. The other piece of this puzzle that's changed is that we have much more intense storms today associated with this climate variability as well. And so if you just look at this, this happens to be Des Moines record. Early part of the century, the last century, we had 2 years in which had more than 8 days with 1.25 inches. That tends to be how we classify high rainfall events. If you look since mid-1980s, 70s is now, we actually have 8 years of years in which we have more than 8 days with 1.25. So not only is our precipitation trending upward, where our intensity of those rainfall events is also increasing, which says that we basically have got a period in which we're moving everything towards the spring. We have less ground cover out there. We also are moving to more intense storms, which says that we're going to have potential for more erosion coming off of that. We have a number of different things in place that really impact our agricultural system. Plus, the number of workable days is also shrinking as we go through this puzzle as well. So there's a lot of farm management decisions that are coupled with this that we really have not begun to put much of a piece onto yet. So that's kind of a stage of all of this. And then just so you make sure that nobody understands that it's always going to be wet, there's a propensity for also increasing drought around the world. So as we look at this in terms of the drought index, we're seeing all of this. We see much more droughty conditions on a worldwide basis, and that's projected to increase as well. So on one hand, we got increased rainfall one part of the season, the other part we're going to have drought is going on. What it really says is that we have got to focus on really how do we manage this soil, how do we manage the soil in terms of looking at conservation practices and how this puzzle all fits together. Because if you think about the climate impacts on agriculture, the temperature basically gives us a hastened plant growth. They grow more quickly. They go through the phenological stages more quickly. But at the same time, because of the increased temperature, they're increasing their water use. So even though the plants are growing quicker, they're pumping more water into the atmosphere. And if you really think about the propensity for stress along the way, you get a decreased yield. And so when you look at a lot of the long-term climate models, is that we do begin to project a decrease in yields, and we've seen that in lots of different cases. And variability in yields is enormous. Precipitation, this increased variability in amounts, both frequency and amounts, decreased frequency, increase in amounts, total precipitation over the year may not change a whole lot, but how we receive it is going to change a great deal. So that leads us to increased variability in the soil water availability. So it really begins to play out in a way in saying, how do we begin to look at the management of our overall system to be able to buffer against some of these extremes that climate is going through? And it really comes back to a focus on soil management, focus on soil conservation, bringing those pieces together in a way to say, how do we weatherproof our cropping systems against some of the extremes that they're going to face? Because here's another reality along the way, and if we think about production over years and we just use a very generic curve and say we're on this linear relationship, however, if you look at At the end of this month, we're going to reach our 7th billion person on this globe. We are basically in what I call a production deficit. We're going to be headed towards very, very quickly the capability of being able to meet our food production needs. If you translate that back, because it takes water to grow these crops, is that we ultimately have a water deficit. So we have a food production deficit. We have a water deficit that's going to exaggerate all of this. It really gets us back to this point of saying, how do we begin to blend these conservation practices together to be able to address this? So I'm going to give you my circle of life of how I think this works. we can debate this all you want, but let's just start down at this, the idea of reducing CO2 emissions to the atmosphere. We'll start on our lower left-hand corner of the curve. So if we reduce CO2 into the atmosphere, either decreasing tillage, retaining the residue on the surface, so that ultimately we end up with cover crops, anything that does that in terms of increasing carbon input into that, what we really do is we begin to increase the organic matter. We increase the organic matter in the soil. Keith has talked about this in his talk. As we talk about it from a carbon sequestration, I'm going to talk about it from the advantages of what it does to the plant. Once we begin to increase that organic matter, we increase the biological activity within that soil. We sustain that biological life. Ultimately, what we really end up doing is increasing the soil water holding capacity of that soil. Once we begin to increase the soil water holding capacity, we can then think about different crops and different rotation selections. We can begin to think about what cropping mix we put on there. We can either intensify that cropping system, do a number of different things. Once we increase plant growth, couple that with improved nutrient management, just as Neville was talking about, all of those pieces come together, we end up with a nitrous oxide reduction. And a lot of the nitrous oxide reduction that we see are not discounted and not disjointed from carbon management. Improved aeration, improved soil water dynamics, all of those things come together. And that's why I give you it as a circle around here to really begin to think about that all of these factors interplay. We tend to often go down a road of here's soil carbon, here's soil nitrous oxide. They're kind of arrows headed in a different direction. But when we get into a cropping management system, they're all parts of the puzzle. They're all parts of the same puzzle that we need to think about. How do we bring them together in many different ways? If we look at conservation practices in terms of very simply, in terms of how do they increase infiltration, how do they increase the carbon content, how do they increase the aggregate stability, and how do they mediate the extremes in soil temperature and soil water content. All of those things are actually operating simultaneously. We think about that protection of that crop residue on top of the surface, even though it's mediating the temperature extremes. It's basically reducing the rainfall energy that allows us to maintain an infiltration rate. If we maintain that infiltration rate in the soil, we have less runoff. As we begin to increase the carbon content and organic matter, we're going to increase water holding capacity. Something that's often forgotten is that when we increase the aggregate stability associated with this, we increase the gas exchange capabilities. We move a lot more oxygen, CO2, back and forth. We avoid some of these issues in terms of nitrous oxide generation because we have a lot more capability of exchanging gases back and forth between the soil and the atmosphere. And so we avoid the extremes of denitrification a lot of times. So we avoid a lot of these issues that are going on. So these conservation practices, you begin to wrap around them in many different ways and how they work. Because I'll put it in this perspective for you. Because everybody wants to grow 300 bushel corn across the Midwest. The realization that escapes most people is that to go from where we're at today to 300 bushel corn, if we keep the same water use efficiency curve, is going to take another 120 millimeters of water. 120 millimeters of water is not going to become from increased rainfall. It's going to become from increased soil water storage within that profile. Now, think about what you're going to have to do to change a soil to increase the water holding capacity 120 millimeters. Remembering that I just told you that we're now going to have less rainfall during the summer. I'm not sure we can increase organic matter that much within our soil to be able to achieve that goal. But it's how we have to begin to think about the problem. We have to think about the problem in terms of what's it take to grow this crop, what's it take to sustain this, and everything else. Because if we think about this, linking it back to climate change, is that we will have an increased water demand from crops through increased temperature. If you just look at that piece of the puzzle, we often look at what's growing in terms of CO2, in terms of increased growth. That's actually offset by the increase of temperature that's out there. This more variable precipitation is going to give us more variation in water supply. So things are not going to be as stable as we once thought. The other piece of this is that to overcome this effect is going to require we take the E out of ET. Is that we look at this total evapotranspiration going back out, conservation practices also begin to shift us to having more water available as transpiration and less evaporation going on to that. That also has some global climate effects as well in different parts of the time, but in reality increases our transpiration available to that crop. An aspect that's in this, if you look at the work by Hudson, he went through and he looked at different organic matter contents, whether they be sand, silt loam, silt clay loams, is that the more organic matter we can add to that soil, there's a linear relationship to water holding capacity. So the more water we have in that, it is a greater sponge and allows us to work from that perspective. If you look across the field, this happens to be actual data coming out of one of our fields in Iowa. The upper two lines are a Webster soil. Our organic matter content in that soil is about 4.5-5%. The Clarion soil is in that order of that 1.5-2%. These are the total water use throughout the whole season. You see the Webster soils are on the top. We see a little difference in terms of nitrogen management on that crop. Total water use on that Clarion soil is about 350 and about 500 plus on that Webster soil. And so those Clarion soils have low yields because they have low water available to them through the whole year. And when we've dissected this in different ways, we begin to see this puzzle. Whoops. If we just look, and this is some of Don Rakowski's work, 5 hours after tillage, 24 hours after tillage, different mowboard plows all the way to no tillage systems in there, is that we see these rapid bursts of CO2. He's seen this on an individual plot basis. We've actually seen it on a mesoscale basis. We actually have a CO2 sensor that's at 65 meters on a tower. When they begin to cultivate in the fall, we see a change in the atmospheric concentration from about roughly 385, 390, and when they're doing lots of cultivation, fall cultivation, as we'll see that amount jump up to an order of 420, 430 parts per million. And so on a mesoscale, we see this large thing that everybody sees. This burst of CO2 that we've stored all summer is released back to the atmosphere. And once we release it, it no longer impacts us. What we see, the wider we make that cross-sectional area, again, some of Don's work, is the greater the carbon loss coming out of that soil. So more broadcast tillage is a greater carbon loss than a very narrow strip that's out there. And so all of these things play in terms of this puzzle that's there. So if we look at soil water, soil carbon, if we adopt practices to reduce carbon loss, they're going to have a positive impact on soil water balance and a reduction of soil water evaporation. Because the things that we use to achieve more carbon basically change that E out of ET component in there. The positive impact of putting organic matter into the soil gives us a chance of increasing future organic or soil organic matter. We can begin this process of moving forward, again, back to that cycle. The more plants we can grow, the more root material we can put into that, the greater positive response we have. This is just some strip data on on this. These are different soils, different nitrogen responses in terms of frequency curves. The thing I want to point out is our low organic matter soils are always off on the left side of that soil, left side of those graphs. Our higher organic matter soils have a tendency to have higher yields. These are strips across fields with different soils in them. So this yield variation that we see across fields is really related to soil water availability. If it was simple as changing nitrogen rates, we'd have very uniform yields on a lot of our fields. But it's really a soil water component that changes it. We've spent a lot of time on nitrous oxide. This is some of Tim's work, where we have automated chambers. We're doing CO2, nitrous oxide, and methane flux every 6 hours. They basically run almost all the year, except when it is now snow covered, we shut them down. Not that we assume that nothing's happening there, we just can't get the lids to go back and forth with the snow banks that are out there. We've been looking at stabilized materials. We've been looking at super or coated materials like ESN or Super U. We looked at stabilizers as NSERV versus Agritain, some of the things that Neville was asking for. We've been looking at and saying, what do they really change throughout the year? A number of different things that are going on. It's not as straightforward as you might expect, because there is this very interesting interaction between the pools of nitrate, the pools of ammonia, the forms of nitrogen, and the precipitation events and their occurrence throughout the year. Because we often see large releases of nitrous oxide late in the season, particularly when we have a very wet late summer condition. We saw this very much in 2009, 2010, in which we had extreme rainfall events, and the nitrate pool was there available to be denitrified. So our mitigation strategies, when we really think about it, we can increase CO2 by canopies. We can increase the carbon storage within that. One of the things that we see is that carbon that's lost out, CO2 that's lost out of the soil during the summer with a full canopy never makes it to the atmosphere. It's basically recaptured by the plant and it's recycled within that canopy. We changed nitrous oxide loss through improved nitrogen management, alternative N forms. Overall, we do see a positive impact on that have a potential for reducing global warming, much like both Keith and Neville were talking about. All of those different pieces. But our conservation practices, we roll with this. We can increase carbon storage into the soil. To do that, we're going to have to promote conservation tillage. We have to maintain that crop residue on the surface. Both of those things have got to go together. The piece that we haven't talked about is then for all this really to work is that we need to maintain a relatively regulated soil water and soil temperature regime within that for the biology to express itself. Biology does not work well if it's going through large extremes of temperature and large extremes of moisture. And so when you begin to moderate that by the residue layer, then you allow that organic matter to build up. If we think about decreased nitrate or nitrous oxide and CO2, is that more we can improve soil structure through soil or aggregate stability, the less we see in terms of denitrification going on within that profile. We see a better expression of the different management practices that we have there. And that allows us to improve nitrogen management or nutrient management. It also allows us to have a better uptake efficiency because we see an improved nitrogen use efficiency by those cropping systems. So all of that goes back to that circle of all those different pieces that I was telling you. So this is nitrous or conservation practices. Are a critical step in how do we buffer against the extremes of climate change. They're also critical of how we're going to optimize the efficiency of our cropping systems to allow them to cope with extremes of climate change as well. So with that, thank you.
I particularly like your emphasis on organic matter as a way of increasing water holding capacity and therefore resilience. So I have two questions. The first is a quick clarifying question. In your circle, you have more soil water as a precondition of changing crop rotations. And why would that have to be the case?
It doesn't always have to be the case. It just makes a good point that if I want to, and I use the Great Plains as an example. If we wanted to go from a crop fallow rotation to an every other year crop rotation, or every year crop rotation, the thing that limits us is soil water availability. And so if the only way I can make that work is that for every, I've got to produce more crop per drop,
so
and I've got to store it.
Yeah,
and even if I think about even in the Corn Belt area, if I want to think about intensifying that system in terms of increasing my plant population, going to narrow rows, a number of different things that are associated with that, and still maintain my potential producing yield, I've got to have the water there to support that. And when we see this variation across fields, that's really related back to soil water dynamics. If I would improve, and what we work with producers, if we improve their capability of storing more water in those low organic matter soils like the Clarion Canisteos that we have in our landscape, is that I can either increase my planting density on that, or I can increase my yield out of it. Either way, end up to an intensity. So it's really about water. Keith, you had a question.
Yeah, just real quickly, I was sitting here, it's a tremendous presentation, really compelling facts and conclusions, I think. And then I started thinking, so Jerry, you work a lot with politicians sometimes, but you also work with farmers, and a fair number of the guys that you probably work with might be in the sort of denier crowd. And I'm kind of curious how you deal with this message and...
The deniers?
No.
Oh.
How do you get the message across with the proper degree of urgency to people that may not want to accept the underlying or an important underlying premise of the whole argument?
Well, everybody hear that question? It's basically how do you handle politicians, but who don't understand this process. And it's a tough one from one standpoint. And actually, the producer community, the question that I always put back to them, and a very simple question, is it's just the one that Neil asked, and that is, what are you going to do in your cropping system to avoid the wide swings in yield that we know occur when we have more extreme weather? And because the variability of weather is increasing, and that's, I've got a whole series of graphs in terms of yield variation over time, and actually they see yield variation, they see this yield variation within their fields, all of this, and it really comes back to getting them to internalize that for their individual farming system. One of the questions that I always ask producers is, can you tell me which of your fields are making you money? You know, and I go back to the fact that a lot of them farm 10 fields, 15 fields, you know, any number of fields out there. And it's invariably you get this blank look back because they really have not thought about which fields are profit centers, which fields are loss centers. And so we have this dialogue about it because it said if you've got a field that's a loss center, it's not making you money, you're not doing the right thing on that field. And they go, well, I hadn't thought about it that way. And so it's a matter of really getting them to understand these dynamics in many different perspectives. And I think that's a part of it. You know, and that's why I do the thing with the production deficit, everything. Politicians are very worried about food security. I mean, you got to get it into a point, the framework that they understand. You know, we can talk about water deficits and soil carbon and nitrous oxide, and we all know how well that goes, Keith. But, you know, but if we talk about a food security deficit and the case of increased variability, it becomes a different metric. Chris?
How different are your conversations with farmers who own the land versus farmers who rent? And, you know, I live in Iowa, too, and we're seeing auctions. options, $700 an acre land right now.
Yeah, well, I mean, it's the this whole, and that's a very interesting issue. We should have a whole symposium on that. That, but in reality, the landowner, land operator are two different things. Just to acquaint everybody, Illinois right now is at 75% cash rent. I think that's the number. Iowa's what, 60, something like that?
At least 60
and climbing. So we, most of our land is rented. And what I, when we work with landowners, one of the things that we tell them is that part of this practice that they do is really for the long-term sustainability of their land. And once they become convinced of that, they often ask their operators which practices they're using on the land. The tougher one at times is the land operator on the short-term two-year option, because these practices take longer than 2 years to achieve. And so it's a really mix of how do we begin to blend all these things together. Right.
You know, I mean, that'll be the case.
Yeah. And we see a lot of short-term tillage to be able to do lots of different things. It's just interesting.
I don't know. Maybe I shouldn't have asked this question, but I'm going to ask it anyway. So, wait, you talk to landowners or renters. I mean, I didn't know that there was that much land rented. I was assuming that it was more land. I was probably losing that. Do they care as much as when you own the land?
Well, the point that you can make to the land operator is still, because they're paying, what, we got some land going for $350 now an acre? Right. I mean, you're talking about cash rents anywhere from $350 to $700. The thing that when we talk to land operators about that is, how do you begin to ensure that you can at least pay the rent back? You know, what are you going to do in this system over time? And again, it's back, a lot of it's nutrient management, a lot of it's long-term in terms of reducing this. How are you going to manage this to recover extremely high cash rent values in a changing climate world? And it's a tough conversation to have with them, but it's one that actually, when they begin to internalize it, they begin to go, yeah, we really got to think about this problem differently.
Do they have crop insurance? Do they have
crop insurance? All of them have multiple.
Now they're talking about tying the conservation practice to crop insurance. That might be a good
I think that could be one of the better things we do.
I know. So that might be.
But don't quote me on being USDA policy on it.
Before we leave, I'd like to thank Jeremy and all the speakers. I think you did a great job. I mean,